Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for March 11th, 2012, one of my favorite days of the year, the day in which the time changes and we get another day, another hour of daylight a day. I'm David McLaughlin. Welcome, as always, Catherine Smith.
Hello, welcome from Atlanta.
And just north of me, welcome in Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, big week in politics today. Later in the show, we're going to talk to Brad Crone, one of our North Carolina experts, about what's going on in North Carolina with all their statewide races. They're in a, you know, maybe the only southern state that has their governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, all those races on the ballot with the presidential race, also a swing state. So good to get Brad in to discuss all that. And then in the first half of the show, we're just going to talk about a myriad of topics, including last night there was a film that came on HBO, and I know when it was originally put together, they thought it would be a feature film at the movies and ended up being an HBO special, but I don't think that really hurt the quality after watching it. They certainly got, you know, their main three actors were box office quality, and that was Game Change. I think all three of us have read the book. And, Tim, you and I were able to watch the movie. Catherine, you were, I guess, busy with other things. That shows that you probably have more of a social life on a Saturday night than Tim and I do.
Oh, no, I was home reading under Hunger Games. Let me just say, I was not social. I was reading.
Okay, we see you're getting ready for one of the next big movies that'll come.
Yes.
That's a different show, so since it's not political, at least overtly political. But the movie, it got more attention than any other political film in recent history. Tim, did it live up to the billing?
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed that movie. It was very good. You wonder how much of it was accurate, but if I'm just guessing, I'd say three-fourths of it was pretty much accurate, maybe more. Woody Harrelson, by the way, did just a great job. And it's the kind of movie that political junkies like us love because it's an insider's look behind the scenes, you know. And it was I really enjoyed that picture. It exceeded my expectations, to be honest with you.
Yeah, Julianna Moore played Sarah Palin. I mean, she was dead on. I mean, she was much more dead on than Tina Fey. Obviously, she was trying to do a realistic portrayal, not a comedic portrayal of Sarah Palin, but it was just incredible how that worked out. And as for if you hadn't seen the movie, what they did is they took the Game Change book, which was just chapter after chapter about every aspect of the election, certainly the major four to five candidates. I mean, they'd have whole chapters on John Edwards and Rudy Giuliani. But they just focused on John McCain from the point when which he wins the nomination and picking Sarah Palin through the election. And it was probably more about Sarah Palin than it was John McCain, and really made John McCain, all in all, look pretty good. Certainly his campaign staff made them look good. The only thing, I guess, that was kind of a knock on John McCain is at one point he's not strong enough to try to rein Sarah Palin in, and that made him maybe look a little weak, so he could have been perturbed about that. But then Sarah Palin, they just rip her over the coals. But if you remember the book and remember the campaign, a lot of that came out. I mean, they didn't even talk about her thinking Africa was a country. Now, I had never heard the part where she thought the Queen of England was still the political head of, you know, the British government. Catherine, I'm trying to bring you in on this. Had you heard the where Sarah Palin thought that the Queen was the head of the British government still?
I remember that, yeah.
So you remember that. I did not remember the other, but there were so many things like that. You know, being able to see Russia and thinking Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. There were so many things, it's hard to remember one detail, don't you think, Tim?
Oh, yeah. But still, I think they hit most of the really major stuff, especially the botched interviews and how they prepped her for the debate and how there was a little friction between her and McCain's people and the people that were assigned to her out of the McCain campaign. So I think with the 2 hours they had to work with, they really got a lot of stuff in. Like I said, if you haven't seen it, folks, you owe it to yourself to see this one. You'll really enjoy it.
Yes, I mean, Nicole Wallace, who was the Bush press secretary, showed her interactions, and those were fascinating. At the end, she's like, I didn't vote, and I guess somebody can check voting records to see, but apparently she did not even vote in the election because she couldn't bring herself to vote for Sarah Palin for vice president, or couldn't vote for, a Democrat, I guess. So it was kind of interesting that that's how strongly she felt after working with her for a while. I mean, basically said, if I have to work with her anymore, I quit, but you can fire me. I don't even care at this point. I mean, that's strong language, but that's how she felt. Another thing that was interesting film-wise was that every time they showed the president and vice president, they would show them just in real file footage. Even the media reporters were all shown from file footage, and some of those may have been actually in the movie. I got the sense that the Anderson Cooper part, he actually was in the movie, but not, for instance, Joe Biden, they took his debate performance and spliced it somehow with Julianna Moore playing Sarah Palin, and they were on stage together, and you couldn't tell that they hadn't gotten Joe Biden to come in and, you know, film himself, which obviously he didn't. I mean, that's just not appropriate for a vice president to do in this setting, but that's how technologically advanced this thing was. Catherine, have you seen any clips of it? Or Tim, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to make one more mention of an interesting interaction between Smith, Woody Harrelson's character, and Governor Palin right at the end of the film. She had apparently decided that she was going to make a concession speech too, which no vice presidential candidate ever had, and there was this huge struggle, and of course Smith, you know, went off the deep end on her, and I thought that was interesting. I wonder exactly how much of that was, you know, accurate. But I still find it very interesting. I don't doubt that she was planning on doing that.
I'm sure she was.
Yeah, that she was planning to. Now, what she actually said and how adamant she was, that's where the creative license may have come in. Well, one final thing. I just can't wait for Game Change 2, where they pick up all the John Edwards portions of this thing. I think that'll be a great sequel. I don't think we'll ever see Game Change 3, because even though the race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton was so fascinating, it's not the kind that would make for a movie unless you were a true political junkie, whereas obviously the Edwards stuff would be salacious and could maybe handle a Game Change too, because when you read it, that was, I guess, some of the more interesting chapters as well. Well, let's move on, you know, in the future one election. And the GOP, they had Super Tuesday, and maybe a little bit was decided. I wouldn't say a lot was decided. I would definitely say that Mitt Romney has no mandate to be the Republican nominee. But mathematically, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich didn't do really much to catch up to him. Catherine, where do you think we stand?
Well, you're absolutely right. As far as the delegate count goes, you know, Mitt is, you know, getting more and more ahead of them. But, you know, like I've said all along, he's just like, nobody really, it just seems like nobody really likes him. You know, they vote for him, I guess, out of, you know, I think generally people are voting, I don't know, I haven't talked to anybody that voted for him, but it seems like people are voting for him because they think he's the only, he's the one who's going to win. Like, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy or something, but I was surprised at how late we went in Ohio. I thought, what did it turn out? I can't remember what the numbers were, but even in Georgia, obviously Gingrich won handily, but Rick Santorum came in third with almost 20%. I can't remember what the final numbers are, but if he gets over 20%, he's going to get some of the delegates. So I don't think it was decided. Obviously, there's a lead in the numbers, but I think sort of emotionally and that people have not picked Mitt Romney yet.
Yeah, I think if it was a boxing match, it'd be a TKO in the 15th round in Ohio. Sure. It was that close, and that's about the best year. Or maybe, I guess it wouldn't be a TKO; it'd be a judge's decision, and after going the full fight, because I was actually watching DVR shows as late as yesterday from Tuesday night, and I think with as much as 33% of the vote in, Santorum still had a lead, so it took that long for Romney to win. Tim, where do you think we stand?
Well, I still think Romney is going to scratch and claw his way to the nomination. He still maintains a good lead in delegates. He does have more delegates than the other three candidates combined. Catherine, on that Georgia thing, if you get over 20% also in any congressional district, you can also get a delegate that way. And apparently Santorum is going to get three delegates in Georgia, or that's what they estimate. If you look at a map of the country, David, and you see Santorum winning in the heartland, you also see Romney failing to do anything in the South other than Virginia, where nobody but Dr. Paul was on the ballot with him, and in Florida, which is not your traditional southern state. He's still not able to do anything there. So this week, here we come with Mississippi and Alabama. And Gingrich is making a stand in Alabama, and Romney is making a huge play for the state of Mississippi. He needs, I don't know, he needs to appeal to the base. He keeps trying to run to the right, eating grits or whatnot. and he's just having trouble with the most conservative voters. And Santorum still needs that one-on-one race because he needs about 60% of the remaining delegates just to win the nomination. He's not going to do that with Gingrich in there. I guess. Go ahead.
You mentioned the grits and y'all comment. It's just absurd. And I don't know if that's your base, because I'm sure a lot of Southern Democrats eat grits on at least a weekly basis, if not some a daily basis, depending on where they get to eat. I know I eat grits whenever I can, and I'm sure not going to vote for Mitt Romney or anybody else in that party. So, you can tell he's just grasping at straws to connect with the party's base. The GOP party's base is the white Southern male. I mean, that is the core of their constituency. And Mitt Romney, they just don't like. And so it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, are they going to say, hey, he's all we've got, we've got to come around? Because he's, obviously the odds-on favorite to be the nominee. Or are they going to say, let's vote for, some other right-wing yahoo that's on the ballot, or does somebody bubble up and just make it a splinter party? They used to have the old Dixiecrat party back in 1948, maybe 52. I wonder if there could be a Dixcan party where you get a Southern Republican that runs to the right and culturally to the right of Mitt Romney and siphons off votes because he is so unconnected or disconnected with these base voters. Catherine, what do you think?
Well, it might be a little late to have something like that happen, but you're absolutely right. The guy just can't connect with he's just stiff and he has no sense of place. Like, no matter where he goes, he looks the same. He talks the same. He's like, I don't see him winning Mississippi. I don't see it, but I've been wrong a lot, so I just don't see it.
And you get the sense that the guy would, he'll go to Starkville and he'll wear a Mississippi Bulldog shirt, and then he'll go to, you know, Oxford and he'll be for Ole Miss, and he's just not core when it comes to that kind of thing. He's pandering, and it's pandering on, you know, just nonsense, how it looks type stuff, not even important stuff like issues, if you will. And so, you know, I don't know what he's going to do. I do think he may end up taking two losses in these two southern states. I think Santorum may sweep both of them. I think Gingrich may fade some in Alabama because to me, I think the Republican Party in Alabama is not that much different than Mississippi, and they're going to see the culture conservatism of Santorum and see that, you know, Newt Gingrich really didn't have much of a chance, and they may just move over from Gingrich to Santorum, and that'll be where the movement comes. That gets kind of in our next question. Why in the world is Gingrich staying in this thing? I mean, he's won one state, and then he won his home state, if you will, of Georgia. Couldn't even get on the ballot in what's really his home state now, Virginia. And they showed something, I think it was on Nate Silver's blog on New York Times, where his Georgia primary win was the weakest primary victory by a home state candidate in modern history. I mean, Tim, tell me, why is he still in this race?
Two words, Citizens United. I've mentioned this before. With the new laws, compliments of our friends at the Supreme Court, he will, even a guy like him, will have enough money to hang around as long as no one mathematically has the thing won. In former elections, guys like this would have already been forced out of the race because their funding simply would have dried up. But when you got one guy handing you $5 or $10 million, well, you know, that's a good little bit of walking around money in some of these states. And so just couple that with the overriding vanity of Newt Gingrich, and there you are. He's not going to go anywhere. He has no reason to go anywhere, and plus the front runner can't close the deal anyway. So, but Santorum has just got to be almost screaming, man, get out of this race, get out of my way, because that the calendar is turning on all of these guys, and the later it gets, the more. You know, the more likely it is that Santorum cannot have a path to the nomination. I think Gingrich's path, obviously, is already gone. And plus, Romney needs to close the deal in order to turn his attention to the Obama campaign, because he's having to run to the right to try to appeal to these conservatives. And, you know, you got to come back to the middle for the election. So I tell you, they got themselves quite a little mess going here, and I just don't think Newt's going to lead the race. I don't think he'll do it.
Yeah, I think he's planning this for his next move. Catherine, what do you see?
I think it's a combination of Citizens United and Gingrich's ego. I think he has some distorted view of reality that, you know, he can do it, even though all evidence to the contrary, and I don't think he really cares if he takes the party down with him. You know, he's really popular with the talk show guys, like Sean Hannity likes him, and Eric Erickson likes him, so he's always on there talking. They don't really endorse anybody, but they seem to be very fond of him. I think partly just because he's from Georgia, But I think he's just, like I said, all evidence to the contrary, he thinks he can do this.
Let me ask you, I'm wondering if it's not for media purposes anyway, does he see, hey, if Rush Limbaugh's going to self-destruct, Glenn Beck kind of you know, dismantled his empire. Is there an opening for the next right-wing talk show host? And does Newt Gingrich think, hey, if I can raise my profile enough, I'll be it because at least I can, you know, come up with ideas. I can, you know, string three words together. Tim?
Yeah, well, let me ask you something. If Gingrich had dropped out before Super Tuesday, quite obviously Santorum would have won Ohio. Man, we would be doing quite the different talk today, wouldn't we?
Oh, would. I mean, Georgia might have been in play because he would have gotten probably two-thirds of Gingrich's vote in Georgia. That was the second largest state. So he had had the first and the second largest states on Super Tuesday.
Yeah, we could have been talking about Rick Santorum on his way to the nomination right now.
Yeah. Which would be another version of a disaster for the Republican Party. I mean, because basically the comments he said about how he views sex and whatnot are, you know, I mean, they make the 50s look progressive.
Yeah, I know,
and
he
so,
comes with
so
his
out
issues.
Of touch, it would be the bigger problem than, you know, the plastic man Mitt Romney's giving him.
But the very idea that Gingrich is essentially changing history just by hanging around in a race that he has no chance to win speaks volumes about Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, and I don't know how he feels about Romney. Maybe he, not Romney, well, I don't know how he feels about him either, but maybe he really doesn't like Santorum for the party. Maybe that's part of it. He's saying, hey, if I stay in, I just block Santorum. Because as bad as Romney is, I think Santorum would really be a setback for the party because, I mean, a lot of their party obviously doesn't agree with him because if not, every Republican have about seven kids because they wouldn't believe in contraception or sexual relations for enjoyment.
Yeah, but I think Newt thinks about Newt. He's not thinking about all those things you just said. He is having the time of his life out here on television, on the evening news, the microphone stuck in his face so he could talk. I mean, he is having the time of his life with this, and he's apparently got himself a sugar daddy to help him ride along down the road. But Newt is loving this.
Yes.
I agree with that.
I think you're right about this. This is a lot about his ego. Well, let's continue to kind of talk about primaries in Alabama and Mississippi, and in particularly Alabama, they've got a lot of contested House races. I mean, they've got where you got two Democratic challengers running in the Tuscaloosa area. One was when a party switcher in the South who switched from Republican to Democrat, which is very unusual these days. And then you also have some GOP members that are in trouble. I keep getting a call popping up back and forth, and it's not Brad Crone's number, so I keep trying to get it. It goes away before I can, so I'll try to get back on that if it comes. But anyway, Spencer Baucus and Joe Bonner, two incumbent Republicans, have primary challengers, and it looks like the Tea Party folks, the more right-wing folks, are coming after these guys. Also, you have Mo Brooks, who is the incumbent that the Tea Party is supporting against Parker Griffin. I don't think anybody likes Parker Griffin at this point. I just can't see why this guy continues to go on the ballot. But there's so many of these inter-party battles. Catherine, what's going on here?
Well, I think, you know, it's this Tea Party demanding, you know, conservative purity or whatever you want to call it. And they're not happy with some of these candidates, so they're running primary opponents. You know, it's not... Democrats have done this before, too. Progressive Democrats have run. I mean, we did it here in Georgia when we ran someone for twice in a row. We ran someone against John Barrow because we didn't think he was progressive enough. And it doesn't usually work. You know, I'm not familiar exactly with what their complaints are in these races, but generally candidates reflect their constituency. So,
yeah.
I mean, elected officials reflect their constituencies. As disappointed as I sometimes am in John Barrow, I understand why he, you know, is more to the center or center right than I would like him to be because of his district. So I think it's, I mean, I don't know, but it's likely to be the same in Alabama. But we'll see how successful the Tea Party is and whether they like what they like what they get if they get it.
Yeah, Tim, what's your thoughts on these races?
Well, obviously, the Tea Party wishes to take over as the dominant voice in the Republican Party. And, you know, they don't want to discuss that with anyone. They're not the type of bunch that wants to discuss anything with anybody. They're that Parker Griffith is, too. You mentioned him running again. And this time he's loaning his own campaign several hundred thousands of dollars. I didn't know he had that kind of money, but obviously he does. But he needs to face reality. Did you see, by the way, on the Alabama, if you ran down the Alabama ballot, the possible candidates for U.S. Senator, there's absolutely a Democrat by the name of Albert Gore. I wonder how that's going to play in Alabama.
Should have high name recognition.
Yeah, really.
You're going to
be like, why'd you move down here?
Yeah. So, that's kind of a strange thing.
Dave,
I mean, obviously, he'll do well in the Democratic primary. I'm assuming it's a he. You never know. It could be a lady, Albert.
David, another thing I'm wondering, in a lot of these legislative races and stuff over there, if there's going to be more Democrats running, like in Alabama and stuff, than there will be here in Georgia. You know, facing
they have races to vote on. I mean, unless you had a municipal race or you had a splost or some type of alcohol sale vote, there was not a competitive race to vote on. Luckily, we didn't have Randall Terry on our ballot like Oklahoma did, and that's something we hadn't gotten to, but that was going to drive down turnout in Georgia among Democratic voters. And if people had splossed on the ballot, that hurt those splossed because Democratic voters are more likely to vote for splossed than Republicans.
But I'm wondering,
I don't know if in our area a splossed failed, and I guarantee you they put it on a ballot when there were Democratic elections, too, it probably would
pass. No, I'm wondering about November, though, David. Do you think the Alabama Democrats are absolutely going to be able to put more candidates on the ballot to contest against some of these incumbent Republicans, more so than they will here in Georgia? You know, we've been having a lot of trouble with that in some of these state legislative races.
That may get back into our discussion of last week. If their executive director is on staff, able to do their job, if their party chair, if everybody's able to work on candidate recruitment, fundraising, targeting, then they may have an easier time if they're not doing other things, and I'm being very nice, but if they're not spending their time. But if they're spending their time poorly and having, you know, personnel battles, then that takes you off your focus. If you're like, hey, what was that discussion about? We spent a good half hour on it last week. Well, before Brad comes on in and we talk about North Carolina, let's get into South Carolina. Their Lieutenant Governor, Ken Ard, resigned this week and may be facing prosecution. Tim, tell us more about that.
He had to hang it up. He was he pled guilty to four counts of unlawful reimbursement of campaign funds, two counts of failure to report, and another count of using campaign funds for personal use. He obviously went on some $3,000 and $4,000 spending sprees. And so he resigned Friday right before he entered those guilty pleas. And like you said, he could face some more criminal counts and jail time. And the Senate President Pro Tem over there, fellow by the name of Glenn McConnell, took the oath of office 2 hours after he resigned. Now, this follows on the heels, you know, of what happened with the Latin lover a couple of years ago, the former governor. That's quite the interesting state, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you got to think the Republican Party has had Mark Sanford, and then mm-hmm. Andre Bauer had ethical issues. Now Ken Ard
yep.
and Nikki Haley has popularity problems. I'm sure somebody might have some ethical things to bring up. I mean, you can't be in office post-1990 without somebody bringing something up. But I know her popularity's been hurting. So, Catherine, how much damage do you think the South Carolina Republicans can incur before it actually starts hurting them in elections? Because it hasn't. They hold every race.
I think it's just a matter of time before this stuff starts catching up with them. It just depends on how strong the Democrats are at pointing all this out and, you know, how well-funded they are to keep their message of, you know, whatever it is, transparency, you know, ethical government, all those kind of issues that, while they seem kind of dull, I think after a while, after, you know, time after time of ethical challenges and, you know, these, you know, broken marriage vows and all this kind of stuff, I think after a while, it doesn't become dull anymore to talk about ethics.
Yeah, but I mean, in Georgia, Glenn Richardson, Sonny Perdue had some issues with land.
What?
Nathan Deal, that failed outdoor store that got resold for some type of pawn sex store. I mean, all those things started stacking up. I mean, the Glenn Richardson stuff was very meaty. It was very easy to understand. It wasn't complicated like some of these scandals are. And it seemingly did nothing to the Republicans in Georgia. I mean, they increased...
Well,
their House majorities. I mean, my fear is that this may not hurt the Republicans in South Carolina that much. We may, and the only race we can actually look at it against will be the presidential race, and it's hard to say that a lieutenant governor scandal should affect a national race like the presidency in that state.
Again, I think it has a lot to do with how the opposing party responds to all that. You know, I mean, I think it requires a, you know, strong party to, you know, bolster against, you know, to have strong candidates who are outspoken and fight back against those kind of issues. And I think that's where, I mean, it's one thing to have these problems. It's another thing to have someone respond to them and push them back on the Republicans.
Yeah. And I guess the next question, I looked on Politics One. I love looking at it as a resource just to quickly see who's running, when the election dates are, and what have you. And I looked. They have Ken Ard's name taken off as lieutenant governor. They have the Senate pro tem moved in there. But they don't have an election date. Tim, what's the procedure? Are they having a special election, or
see,
does he get to serve out the rest of the term?
I've been trying to find that out myself, but it seems that the way they're talking, that he just might serve out the term. That's law over there, because some people were saying, you know, they need to change their law over there. So
yeah,
I don't know. And another thing, too, see, the lieutenant governor and the governor, just like in Georgia, do not run as a team. They run independently of each other. So I just don't know what they would do.
Well, and I mean, obviously, the presidency, going back to that, if the president dies in office, the vice president serves the remainder of the term. I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do. Even if you had a different party or somebody that was in the same party that didn't see eye to eye, I mean, it is just your succession plan. I think Richard Cody became governor of New Jersey a while back and serve the rest of the term. So it's not unprecedented that would happen. So I don't know that should be a bad thing, but obviously if it became an election that was on the November ballot, then it would give a little more juice to the South Carolina elections and then might affect the other races, be them state house,
well,
state senate, and things like
that.
There's
another thing, too, that Senate pro tem president. He was not very happy about this. That's an important position he had to vacate for a largely ceremonial position, because the lieutenant governor in South Carolina has practically no pull of any kind. So there's just a lot of people saying that they really need to change the laws over there.
Oh, I tell you what, Tim. If me at my stage in life with kids and all, if you gave me any office in Georgia politics, I'd take lieutenant governor's job. I'd work the year and have the rest of the nine, other than, you know, cutting some ribbons and different stuff to be with my family. So I think it's one of the more underrated jobs in politics if you in that stage of life. Now, once you have more time to give to the people, if you will, then maybe it's not that good. But it's always a stepping stone for higher office, because you can spend a lot of time in politics if you have to. Well, let's move up to the next Carolina and welcome in Brad Crone again to the Kudzu Vine.
Hello, how are y'all?
Good to have you on again.
Yes, sir. Good to be here. Interesting
yes,
times
well,
in North Carolina politics, no doubt.
Yeah, well, South Carolina had a little controversy, but North Carolina has some interesting races, too. Obviously, y'all have more races than anybody in the South. And I think since we last talked, Beth Perdue jumped out of the governor's race, and that just reshuffled the whole deck, I guess, starting with the top of the ticket. Who's in and who's strong of the candidates in that race?
Well, it's clearly shaken North Carolina politics for the Democratic Party down to its core. The Lieutenant Governor, Walter Dalton, from Rutherford County in the mountains, has jumped into the race, as well as former 2nd District Congressman Bob Etheridge from the Triangle area, former two-time superintendent of public instruction, ran statewide twice, former state House member, and then served 14 years in Congress. And the wild card in the race is a medical trial attorney from Chapel Hill named Bill Faison, who served 6 years now, 7 years in the North Carolina House. Is a multimillionaire and can self-fund. He's probably behind John Edwards, the most prominent medical malpractice trial attorney in the state of North Carolina. So clearly, if Faison decides to put money into it, he will be a factor. The early polling from public policy polling showing Etheridge with the lead right now. It's a double-digit lead, but it's marginal. The key thing in this race is who's going to have the ability to get on television and stay there, and then who's going to have the money to do it. What we're seeing in the eastern part of the state, pretty much all over the state, the money donors have frozen. There's polling data out there that shows Pat McCrory, the Republican likely nominee, he has a primary, but it's a minimalist candidate, former mayor of Charlotte, is clearly leading the race at this point in time. He lost by 100,000 votes to Governor Perdue in 2008. And basically, the man never stopped campaigning. And he's actually built a pretty strong political organization and fundraising base in the eastern part of the state where he got beat, really where he lost the governor's election in 2008. So clearly, McCrory, the Republican, is the front runner in the race. He's raised about $1.4 million. Walter Dalton has cash on hand probably about $1 million to $1.1 million, and Etheridge is out having to raise money. So if Dalton gets up on TV, that's going to be a real interesting race, no doubt. Peter Carey is doing the race, I think, for Walter Dalton, and so he's going to have the media capabilities. Steve Murphy will be doing the media for Bob Etheridge, and then the Wild Bunch out of Washington will be doing Bill Faison. So all of them have lined up very competent media strategists and consultants, and basically we're watching a 40-yard dash, which is unusual in North Carolina politics, in particular on the Democratic side, because the Democrats, when we've had primaries, they've been marathons. Usually starting 9 to 10 months prior to the primary date, the candidates will go out, visit all 100 counties, set up a county chairman, set up a county finance committee, set up a county sign committee, have an organization of people in place who are supporting them to run a political apparatus. And we're not seeing any of that at this point in time. From an organizational standpoint, Dalton may have that advantage because over the last 4 years as lieutenant governor, he's been able to go out and travel the state and build that organization. So clearly a wild, wild race that we're going to have going into the May primary.
Yes, you mentioned wild, wild card, wild primary, wild bunch media. Now, the other day, or another week, I should say, we discussed Bill Faison and some of the stories that have come out, and we have no idea if they're true or not. But what are the voters of North Carolina making of the stories that have hit the papers about Bill Faison's personal life?
Well, I think that they realize in a divorce situation a whole lot of things are said, some of them true and some of them not true. So I think they're taking that with a grain of salt. The problem is that Faison really hadn't been able to get any type of traction. In one private poll, he's at up at 8%. Public policy polling in Raleigh still showing him at 2%. And he's actually, there's been some data out where he's upside down on his favorable, unfavorable ratings. And that's problematic. That basically means that the donor community is going to let him self-finance if he wants to put his own money in so he can deliver. With that said, David, he has been the first to get on TV. He bought about an $80,000 buy on statewide cable in the major metropolitan markets in Raleigh, Durham, Fayetteville, Greensboro, Winston, High Point, and Charlotte. So he's been up on TV. The media people, media reps are saying that he has gotten avails as well as Dalton and Etheridge. So all of them are looking at probably a 30-day time frame on getting up on television. But, you know, there were some mighty nasty things said about Faison. He's had to face them. The news media has brought him to the public's attention. But I think at this point in time, there was a poll released Friday where Elon University showed that 88% of the respondents to the Elon University poll just didn't know enough information to even form an opinion of them. So a whole lot of room there to educate the voters and let them know about where all of them, Bill Faison, Dalton, and Etheridge are coming from.
Yes. Well, I'm going to pass this over to Catherine. Catherine, ask questions about the governor's race, or if you want to move down the ballot one step and ask about lieutenant governor, that'd be fine with me. Catherine? I tell you what, let's move over to Tim. Tim, you there?
Yes, sir, I am. You were talking about, or making some allusion to undecideds. According to public policy polling, undecided actually leads in the Democratic primary race with a rather hefty 41%. Does that speak to lack of statewide name recognition for these candidates or to the weakness of the field?
A little bit of both, Tim. I would argue that the only candidate with a real base in the race is Etheridge, and he has his base in the Triangle area and eastern part of the state. Walter Dalton comes from Rutherford in Rutherford County, which is in the central western part of the state. Textile, furniture community, their economy's transitioning. But it's probably 30,000, 40,000 population base. So he served in Cleveland and in Rutherford County in the state Senate. Neither one of those are huge population bases, and so that doesn't provide him an opportunity to have a large metropolitan area from which he can pull a base from, and that's perhaps his biggest problem. Dalton's going to have the cash. Dalton's probably got $800,000 to $1 million cash on hand. And to buy a statewide buy across the state, it's about $300,000 a week to buy 1,000 points of television in all our TV markets, stretching from Wilmington to Greenville, Washington, New Bern, through the metro areas along the I-85 corridor all the way up to Asheville. So I think the field's weak in the standpoint that, number one, Democrats weren't really paying attention and didn't expect Perdue to pull the stunt that she did when she pulled out of it and left the field wide open. So Dalton enjoys the role of being the underdog. He's probably that's the role that he likes to play. He likes to be underestimated. and he's very quiet, very reserved, very capable, a heck of a sort of a general attorney. He's a multi-practice attorney from small town, and you know you have to watch out for those small town country lawyers. Etheridge, of course, comes from a small community in Lillington, North Carolina, in Harnett County. He's former county commissioner and served in the state house. He's 70 years old. If he's elected, he could be the oldest governor we've elected in a real long period of time. I can't think back of having a governor elected and sworn in at the age of 71, maybe back to William B. Umstead in 1952, and he was the oldest that I can think of, but he was only 66 years old, I think, when he was sworn in. So the age factor may, you know, play against Etheridge to a certain extent. It's going to be a heck of a primary to watch. Even the Republicans, there were two people who filed minimalist candidates against Pat McCrory, but it will enable McCrory an opportunity to come in and spend a couple $100,000 the last 7 days of the campaign just to put a positive message out. And I think you'll see that too, and that'll help solidify his base within the Republican Party. Then as you go down, Tim, David, as you were saying, the lieutenant governor's race with Dalton seeking the governorship, that created an opening there. On the Republican side, you've got Dale Falwell, who's running state representative from Winston-Salem. He is the Speaker pro tem. And then Wake County former commission chairman, Wake County commissioner Tony Gurley, a pharmacist, and then Dan Forrest, Sue Myrick's son from Charlotte. So basically each metropolitan area of the state has a candidate to run. Interesting thing, the Triangle area represents a little bit higher percentage of your total votes cast in both the Democrat and the Republican primary. So that will be interesting. And on the Democratic side, you've got Linda Coleman, former state house member, former chairman of the Wake County Commission, running against Dr. Eric Mansfield, a first-term state senator, 82nd Airborne physician, and ear, eye, nose, and throat doctor from Fayetteville, North Carolina, was elected to the state Senate 2 years ago, and this is his first statewide run. So both of them African-American, and that's going to be an interesting primary. I'm representing Linda Coleman, so I'm of course, pulling for Linda. I've been working with Linda as a consultant since 1998 and have worked in her county commissioner races and her state house races. And we feel real good about the race. Not since 1996, 1994, have the Democrats had to have had a head-to-head race where a man versus a woman in a two-person contest where the woman hadn't won because women outperform men voters in the Democratic primary 56-44%. So we feel real good about that. Private polling and public polling are giving double-digit lead to Linda. The fact Linda's outgoing, she just resigned last week as the state personnel director under Governor Perdue. She's been active in Democratic Party politics all over the state of North Carolina for almost 30 years now, has a state organization in place. Dr. Mansfield was recruited, interesting enough, by Nina Schlossberg and some of the more liberal members of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And so that's going to be interesting to see how this primary plays out. Regardless of who wins the primary, the Democrats will have a top-level African-American candidate in the second position on the ticket behind the governor's nomination. And that's critically important because of the emphasis the president's going to make on base vote within the African-American community in the state. And as you look at the presidential race, who knows what's going to happen with the Republicans. Obama is looking better and better in the state. Numbers continue to show that the margins beginning to move a little bit for the president, in particular with the most important demographic, and that's your independent voters in the state. They're going to represent almost 25-26% of your total votes cast. So Obama's actually making some moves in the state, positive gains for him in the polling, and that's going to be an interesting race to watch.
Yes, so we've got the presidential race. We also have races even further down the ballot. Catherine, are you there with us? And if you want to decide which direction to go with your question.
I'm here. Sorry about that. I had my mute button on and didn't realize it. Thank you for being with us tonight. We really appreciate it. I wanted to ask you about the DNC convention and how everything's going for the plans in Charlotte.
Went down a couple weeks ago when the third wave had their convention meeting, met with the CEO, Mr. Madigan, Carrigan, from Boston. Very interesting. I think the DNC is really putting on a heck of a show. It will be the backside to the convention story. It's going to be a heck of a show because on Monday, the traditional day that you open the convention, it's actually Labor Day. So they're going to do a family-oriented, rather than going into the convention hall and having, you know, a platform hearing and all the regular dullness of the Monday evening session, they're actually going to have a Labor Day picnic and party out at Lowe's Motor Speedway in Charlotte, and we'll be able to accommodate probably 100,000 people.
Wow.
And they're going to have tents there with all the various groups. Labor will be recognized, Third Way, the DLC. They're going to have a pork cook-off between North Carolina and South Carolina. So you'll have Eastern-style barbecue, Lexington-style barbecue, and your mayonnaise-based, mustard-based barbecue from South Carolina. So that should be an interesting, fun time for everybody. They're going to have a carnival and rides and games out and just make a real fun festive affair. You know, the networks typically don't carry Monday night coverage anymore. So that's going to be interesting. Then Tuesday night, you've got the convention pull, the keynote, and then Wednesday night, the nomination speeches. And then Thursday night, they're going over to Panther Bank of America, Panther Stadium, and have probably 85, 90 to 100,000 people show up to watch the president accept the nomination. So that's going to be really exciting. Then there are a couple of the political people will really be interested. On Saturday night, you're going to have the media party at the convention center, and that's a sellout crowd there already. And they're doing events at the Cornerstone Hotels there to support the already sold-out media event. And then Sunday afternoon, they're going to have the welcome delegates parties. So there won't be any lack of activity or energy or enthusiasm and excitement as people come into the convention. Big question mark is, can they afford it, and how are they going to pay for it? Because they're not accepting any money, corporate money. They're not accepting any lobbyist money, and they're not accepting any PAC money. The entire convention, $44, $45 million of it, is going to be driven by individual contributions. So they're really working diligently right now to get the individual contributions in, and they're making progress. I think they're probably about 60% of goal right now, and by the time the convention rolls through, I'm sure they'll be there and plus some.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. I know that the states are having to raise money for their own events as well, and they're facing some of those same challenges. So I'm sure it'll be a good party. I'm looking forward to I'm not going, but I'm looking forward to watching it on TV.
Well, it's going to be a whole lot of fun. I'm going to go down. I went down to the convention in Atlanta in 88 and really enjoyed that. So I'm looking forward to my second convention and going down and having a big time.
Well, good. Thank you for all that information. I didn't know all that stuff, so that's good to know. And I'm sure our listeners appreciate that. I'm back to you, David.
Well, nevertheless, I've never been in any of the three major sports Charlotte venues you mentioned, but they have to be nicer than the Omni was by 1988, being in that building probably 100 times during my life. Well, we just got you for a little more time, and there's a bunch of congressional races In your states, Sue Myrick, she's resigned since she last been on, or she said she's not running again.
Right.
Heath Shuler's not running again. We can't cover all of districts in North Carolina, so Brad, hit the highlights on the
The most interesting primaries are with the Republicans, and in the 13th, Brad Miller's seat right now, you've got the chairman of the Wake County Commission, Paul Coble, running against the former U.S. attorney who indicted the Speaker of the House, who indicted the Commissioner of Agriculture, who indicted John Edwards. George Holding is his name, and they are going at each other tooth and toenail, back and forth, back and forth. Coble is Jesse Helms' nephew, and George Holding comes from the Holding family, which is the primary stockholder in First Citizens Bank across the southeast. So he can self-finance and has been self-financing his campaign. So they're going at each other. People interested in it, you can Google either one of them and watch that fight blow out. And then Jim Pendergrass against Robert Pittenger down in Charlotte is the other huge race. Pendergraff is the former sheriff of Mecklenburg County, Democrat, was sheriff probably 24, 28 years, changed over from a Democrat to Republican, worked under President Bush at the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and then has been back in Charlotte and has been endorsed by Congresswoman Myrick, has a lot of just political organization, and then Robert Pittenger is a former state senator, multimillionaire. He can self-finance. He's got Dee Stewart from Raleigh running his campaign, one of the best Republican consultants in the nation and in North Carolina, clearly in congressional races. Dee's, you know, really a top-flight consultant. And so they're already up on TV, you know, looking at a $1 million buy on television. So buckle your seatbelts, get you some popcorn and soda, because that is just going to be a heck of a contest down in the 9th Congressional District. Democrats, the races that they're worried about is Kissel. And if I had to bet right now, I'd bet on Richard Hudson being the Republican nominee. Hudson is former district director for Robin Hayes, congressman, middle-of-the-road, centrist Republican, has strong business backgrounds, has worked up on Capitol Hill as the chief of staff. So that race, the 8th Congressional District, keep your eyes on. And then the other race is going to be Mike McIntyre's race in the 7th District, whether it's against the state senator from Johnston County or the former nominee that the Republicans put forth 2 years ago. So clearly, it's a Republican performing district, 54-55%. But those two are the races that Democrats will be paying attention to.
Yeah, and now the 9th and the 10th, one is Heath Shuler's district he's retiring from, which I know the Republicans made more Republican, and they had to throw some of those voters in Patrick McHenry's seat. In the 11th, you have one of the Asheville City Council members. I mean, obviously somebody who serves in office. You got an aerospace engineer, Tom Hill, also running that. And in the 10th district, the Democrats have recruited the mayor of Asheville,
right,
Terry Bellamy, and a state rep, Patsy McKeever. You've got such high-quality candidates recruited. I mean, are these very winnable races for the Democratic Party?
No, they're not. I mean, the 10th is probably a better fighting district for Democrats. It's about a 52% Republican-performing district. But McHenry is just a pure-blooded retail politician. I mean, the guy works all the time. Dee Stewart ran his campaign. They had a huge fight several years ago when he won the nomination first time, probably 6 years ago now, when he beat the sheriff up in Catawba County. So I never underestimate Patrick McHenry in a political race. And Terry Bellamy and Patsy Keever, I mean, that's a hard choice for Democrats. Both of them have great credentials. They're great candidates. That could be a really, really interesting and competitive race if the tide turns with independents, voters, and they look at Democratic candidates to support as we go into November. And in the 11th district, former chief of staff for Congressman McHenry is running in that district, and that's going to be really an interesting fight to watch, but the 11th district is actually the highest Republican performing district. It's almost 56.5% Republican performing district. So for Democrats, that's really tough, Stony Mountain field to plow for Democrats.
Yes, it's just interesting to see. And these, you know, uphill battles that you've got candidates recruited that actually hold elective office, that have won office before. And that speaks to what North Carolina's doing with candidate recruitment. I guess one final thing is how has North Carolina Democrats been so successful with candidate recruitment? I know it's even filtered down in the state House and state Senate. You just lost there, and you're recruiting, you know, for instance, the mayor of Rockingham for a state Senate seat. What's been the plan there?
Well, the Democrats have been proactive. We've really had, in the past, we've actually had stronger benches. Right now the party is transitioning. We're transitioning from the Jim Hunt political organization that's run the state's Democratic machinery and Democratic apparatus literally since 1976. And with Perdue stepping down, that sort of signifies the end of the Hunt apparatus. So the party's really looking for younger, newer, fresher leadership. But as we move forward, we're seeing those people step up. You've got Deborah Walsh. You've got Terry Bellamy. You've got Gene McLaurin, the mayor of Rockingham. You've got several people who have been working in the trenches who have been brought up in the Jim Hunt, Terry Sanford political organization who are stepping up to the forefront. And, you know, that's the great thing. The party has been proactive in going out, recruiting these people, giving them leadership roles, and grooming them so that they can come along. People like Eric Mansfield and Linda Coleman, you know, they represent the future. Marlo Foster, running for labor commissioner. So Janet Cowell, the state treasurer, probably on the trajectory to be in line to run for governor in 4-8 years from now. So the party has invested time, energy, and resources into finding good people and making sure that they have leadership roles so that we can continue to put people forward. Even in tough times when the Republicans have the legislature and, you know, you're going to have a really competitive governor's race, I think the Democrats are making ground and moving forward.
Yeah, well, Brad, fascinating as always. I get the sense we could keep you until 8:30, and you could continue to inform us.
Well, I wish I could, but I've got to run. I've got some errands. I've got laundry to do.
Well, we've got to run, too. I mean, our show, we can go a minute or two over. I'm just saying that you're that informative that you could feel that with no problem, not that we're trying to keep you for another 25 minutes.
Well, I appreciate minutes. It, and I'll be on real soon.
Yes. Well, thanks again,
thank
Brad.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Well, guys, I tell you what, the whole show flew by, but that last half hour, I just looked up at the clock and it was, my goodness, Brad's been on this long way, because it was so entertaining and informative, I was like, where did the time go? But we're a little over 8 o'clock, so that's the Cudsley Vine for March 11th. See y'all next Sunday.
Good night,
guys.
There you go.